Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the shooting of three Muslim university students in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, that, according to the father of two of the victims, is a hate crime, although the shooter posted on Facebook that he hated radical Christians and radical Muslims alike. John Weiler, the Director of Global Studies at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill and author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, joins us to discuss the local reaction to this atrocity and the growing outrage trending on Twitter at the hashtag Muslim Lives Matter, as well as assessing its global impact since anger at U.S. media coverage is spreading in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and other Middle Eastern countries at a perceived double standard that a white American killer is likely to be considered mentally ill, while a Muslim shooter is automatically labeled a terrorist. Then we'll assess the slim chance of a lasting peace agreement coming out of Wednesday's summit meeting in Minsk between the leaders of France, Germany, Russia, and Ukraine with John Mearsheimer, professor of political science and the co-director of the program on international security policy at the University of Chicago. We will discuss his article at the New York Times, Don't Arm Ukraine, and the last-ditch efforts of European leaders to get a ceasefire to make a deal with Putin before the U.S. is likely to start arming Ukraine to counter the superior Russian military equipment with which the Russians are arming their separatist proxies. Then finally, with the six-month suspension of NBC's news anchor Brian Williams for exaggerating his wartime experiences in Iraq, we will speak with a veteran Pulitzer Prize-winning American photojournalist, Lindsay Addario, about her very real experiences on the battlefronts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Darfur, and the Congo, which she documents in her new book, just out. It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. And joining us now is Jonathan Weiler, the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. He is the Director of Global Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he also writes for Durham, North Carolina's Independent Weekly. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Weiler.
Thanks for having me.
And the shooting, the execution-style shooting of three Muslim students in Chapel Hill, I think two of whom were at your university, Jonathan, clearly has shaken the community. But there is, of course, a dispute, if you will, between the wife of the shooter, who says that it was all about a parking spot, and...
Yeah.
And then the father of one of the victims, who said it was a hate crime. So, what is your understanding at this point?
Well, I have the same information you do. I have seen reports that it was actually the father of both women, who were sisters, who were murdered last night, saying that they had had repeated run-ins with the man in custody now. Because he was expressing hateful sentiments toward them because of their faith, and also a friend of the man who was killed, Dia. And I have also seen the report from the suspect's wife that I think what she has said is, well, I know that he's not a racist. So that's what I've seen so far.
But apparently he has had run-ins with these two young Muslim women, I think one of whom wears a veil, and she reported to her father that he had said hateful things to her with a gun tucked in his belt. So is there open carry in Chapel Hill, North Carolina?
There is, as far as I know... I should know this law better than I do. There is not open carry in Chapel Hill. So that would be, I think, a particularly alarming detail.
Well, apparently he posted pictures of his .38 caliber pistol on his Facebook account.
Yes, I've seen the same thing. Yeah.
So this, of course, is not a yet another shooting in America where, you know, obviously because of the NRA, there's we have the best armed criminals and mentally disturbed people in the world. But it's gone beyond that, surely, Jonathan, with the reaction in the Islamic world and the perception. You know, there's this hashtag out Muslim Lives Matter that's spreading around the country and around the world. So this has implications way beyond Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Yeah, I would say that's certainly true. And, you know, I think the context, it makes a lot of sense in context. We had the murders in Paris last month, which, of course, were the focus of worldwide attention. And I think rightfully to many Muslims felt like yet another instance in which as soon as somebody commits murder, according to their however warped understanding of the Quran, every Muslim has to make a profession of denouncing violence before they have any credibility in the public square. So I think in that context, it's understandable that lots of Muslims would be particularly upset by this murder and are rightfully wondering, once we do know more about the killer and his motives, and that is cloudy at the moment, I'm rightfully wondering how he will be characterized.
Well, frankly, Jonathan, it's pretty unusual, surely, to kill three of your neighbors execution style over a parking space.
I certainly agree that would be very far from normal behavior. Yeah.
And apparently the postings on the shooter's postings on Facebook are getting a lot of attention because he denounces religion and he denounces what he calls Christian fanatics or terrorists and Muslim terrorists alike.
Yeah.
And also says he's a fan of Rachel Maddow. So I'm wondering whether Fox News is going to run with this.
They might. You know, it's interesting, and I've been thinking about this a little bit this afternoon. I find somewhat dismaying, and I was thinking about this in the context of the Gabrielle Giffords shooting, I guess it was 4 years ago now, and very immediate speculation about Jared Lochner's, I think that's the man who shot her and killed several people, very immediate speculation about Jared Lochner's politics. And I think I find somewhat depressing the idea that even the sort of political identity of the shooters is now becoming part of our sort of partisan political sport. So that piece of this dismays me. But as I said a moment ago, I think what is fully understandable and valid, I think, is Muslim anger that they seem to be required uniquely to explain themselves and their faith when a similar standard doesn't appear to apply to other people and other faiths.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Weiler, who's the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. He is the director of global studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and also writes for Durham, North Carolina's Independent Weekly. And we're talking about the execution of three young Muslim university students in their, I guess it wasn't so much a dorm, it was a house they were renting, I take it.
I think it was an apartment, yeah.
And they just, two of them had just been married, and the third, a sister of the wife. And he, of course, was a dental student. And both
right.
of them had done charity work in Syria, or at least in Turkey, on the border, trying to bring dental care to the Syrian refugees. So, again, there's a terrible, terrible layer of irony and tragedy here, given...
Well, Ian, let me just add to that quickly. Dia, the man who was killed, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing the name, but he was on Twitter fairly frequently and tweeted, I think, about 10 days ago, his dismay for anybody who professed anti-Jewish or anti-Palestinian sentiments as a complete waste of time and not in any way helping us build toward a peaceful solution. So certainly his own perspective and level of tolerance, I think, have been amply demonstrated.
Well, it feels so ironic to me, Jonathan, that on the very day that President Obama submits his war authorization to the Congress to combat the Islamic State, And and we know that military hardware is not going to stamp out this problem, and and that the last thing that America should be doing is alienating so-called moderate Muslims. And these people that have been murdered are the epitome of the very people that we should be working with throughout the Islamic world to try and isolate the true radicals, and not to brand everybody with the same broad brush. And that seems to be the complaint, both in the Islamic and Muslim media, where they're basically saying, you know, if a white American shoots somebody, he's considered mentally ill, but if a Muslim shoots somebody, he's automatically branded a terrorist.
Right, and that there isn't motivated and all that.
Yeah, and that there isn't. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and I mean, I you know, to put this in somewhat broader context too, you know, of course, the United States has. You know, without reciting the entire litany over the last century or whatever, you know, the United States has been dropping bombs on Muslim countries via drone strikes and other means for years now, and killing large numbers of civilians at wedding parties and in other gatherings. And I think all of that is of a piece with what is an entirely counterproductive strategy, in addition to being an immoral one. So certainly I think this is, you know, kind of a piece of what is really a larger, just a fundamentally misguided approach to these issues.
So obviously we don't know the details of what just happened, but tell us about your town, Chapel Hill. I mean, the father of the two girls who were killed. He has said that this is a hate crime. He's, I believe, a medical doctor. These students came out of a kind of professional background. They, again, they seem to be sort of the very perfect model of how Muslims in America can prosper and integrate. And the idea that somehow they should be targeted for murder is just appalling.
Yeah.
So give me a sense of the community and how it's responding.
Well, you know, it's I mean, Chapel Hill is it's really the epitome of a bucolic college town. About 60,000 people live in Chapel Hill, and it's just a lovely place. And in general, you know, I think there are fewer than 10 murders a year here. And so one implication of that is that when somebody is killed, let alone there's a triple murder, I think everybody feels it here in maybe a particularly personal way. You know, it's not all that likely that you're going to be more than 2 or at most 3 degrees of separation from anybody who's been victimized in this way. So it's especially unsettling here, and as I'm sure you won't be surprised to hear, there's a pretty somber mood around here today as a result.
Well, Jonathan Waller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Waller, who's the author of Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics. He is the director of global studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he also writes for Durham, North Carolina's Independent Weekly. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the summit underway in Minsk between leaders of France, Germany, Russia, and Ukraine.
We've all seen enough. Now it's time to decide the meekness of love or the power of pride. It doesn't matter if you're good or smart. God damn it, things fall apart.
Hey, rejuvenation. Second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation. What is my sin? When will
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Mearsheimer, the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. His books include The Tragedy of Great Power Politics and the bestseller The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. And his latest book is Why Leaders Lie, The Truth About Lying in International Politics. And he has an article at the New York Times, Don't Arm Ukraine. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Mearsheimer.
Glad to be here, Ian.
And this, the talks in Minsk between the leaders of France, Germany, Russia, and Ukraine, they have basically given very little chance of succeeding. It seems that there's a kind of good cop, bad cop strategy going on here, where Merkel and Hollande are doing a last-ditch effort to avert a threat from the American side to arm Ukraine, which the Europeans oppose. What's your sense of where this is likely to end up?
Well, in my opinion, it doesn't really matter whether they get an agreement or not, because all they're talking about is negotiating a ceasefire that is viable. They're not talking about figuring out what is a deal to end this crisis. So in the best case scenario, they'll work out a ceasefire arrangement. It'll last for a few weeks or a few months. With some minor violations, then it'll fall apart and we'll be back to square one. What we need here is some sort of grand bargain between the Russians on one side and the West on the other that ends this crisis and we can get back to the status quo ante, i.e. what was the case before the February 22nd, 2014 coup.
Well, I spoke the other day with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, an independent military analyst in Moscow who writes for Novaya Gazeta, and he said that the West, and particularly the Americans, simply do not understand that Putin is not going to stop until he gets rid of that government in Kiev.
I think it's quite clear that the West has misgauged Putin and Russia more generally from the beginning. What's going on here is that Putin is basically saying to the West that as long as you continue to try and make Ukraine a Western bulwark on my doorstep, I will go to great lengths to wreck that country. Putin is saying that there's no way he's going to allow Ukraine to become part of NATO or to become part of the EU or more generally a part of the West. He just will not tolerate that. For Putin, and this is for good strategic reasons on his part, Ukraine is a core strategic interest. It's of vital strategic importance to him. And he has no intention of letting that country, Ukraine, become part of the West. And he'll bear an enormous cost to prevent that from happening. And of course, he's going to inflict an enormous cost on Ukraine. So what we're doing by continuing this foolish policy is in effect leading the Ukrainians down the primrose path and guaranteeing that we get no solution.
So then, I mean, there is obviously a different European approach to the American approach. And I spoke to a specialist on German politics the other day who said that the Europeans see this situation more akin to World War One, where these alliances are likely to spin out of control and a small incident blows up into a world war. And that's what they want to prevent. Whereas on the American side, particularly with John McCain and Lindsey Graham, they keep referring to the beginning of World War Two, the appeasement of Hitler at Munich. So there are different perceptions on this. But in terms of appeasement, then, what happens to the Ukrainian people who want to have a better life with transparency, rule of law, and integration in Europe? You just simply have to sell them out?
Well, they can have a better life, right? They can have a democracy, and they can have economic prosperity. The point is they cannot be part of the West in any meaningful sense. And that means they cannot be part of NATO and they cannot be part of the EU because the Russians think that is threatening. Now, you may say the Ukrainians have a right to determine their own foreign policy, but this is a foolish way of thinking about international politics. When you're a small state and you live in the same neighborhood as a much bigger state, a guerrilla, you have to respect that guerrilla's interests. If you're Cuba or Canada or Mexico, you do not have the right to just do anything you want in foreign policy. you have to make sure you do not antagonize the United States, because the United States is a jealous God. The same thing is true with the Ukrainians. And the Ukrainians made the fatal mistake of thinking that they could become part of NATO, that they could become part of the EU, that they could become part of the West and live happily ever after. That's not the case. The Russians will not tolerate that. The Russians will tolerate a neutral and prosperous Ukraine. You want to remember that between 1992 and early 2014, there was no problem involving Ukraine. Ukraine was basically a neutral state, and although it was not prosperous, that was Ukraine's fault. It wasn't because the Russians were doing anything to wreck Ukraine.
But the pro-Russian leader there was a kleptocrat, and the people kicked him out, and that seems to be the model that Putin is offering. After all, he runs a huge kleptocracy.
He was a democratically elected leader who was overthrown in a violent fashion. This is not talked about in the West. It's not part of our discourse because we're in the business of blaming Putin. But he was a democratically elected leader, and the United States helped overthrow him. And this is what spooked Putin. This is the event that precipitated the crisis.
So you don't think, John Mearsheimer, that this has anything to do with a model of government, a kleptocracy as opposed to a democracy?
It was a kleptocracy throughout the 90s and throughout the 2000s, up until 2014. The fact that Ukraine is a kleptocracy is nothing new.
Right. So, again, I'm speaking with John Mearsheimer, who is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and the co-director of the program on international security policy at the University of Chicago. His latest book is Why Leaders Lie, The Truth About Lying in International Politics, and he has an article at the New York Times, Don't Arm Ukraine. One of the things that the military analyst from Moscow mentioned the other day, John, is that in terms of this sort of military engagement, which is, he likened to kind of World War One, that it's a static kind of artillery duel along lines, but that he didn't think that there were really a lot of Russian troops involved in it at the moment. He said the Russians did step in back in August when the rebels, or the separatists in eastern Ukraine, were about to be defeated by the Ukrainian army. But what he did say was that what has given the rebels and the Russians an advantage in this, apart from the fact that Russia has enormous advantages because it's a major military power right on that border, is that they have been employing Israeli drones, which struck me as being extraordinary. So here's got John McCain talking about arming the Ukrainians. Is anybody talking about Israel arming the other side?
I've not heard that story. I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. But look, what's going to happen here if we arm the Ukrainians is that the Russians are going to counter-escalate. When you listen to people in Washington talk, and people like McCain and Lindsay talk about the necessity of arming the Ukrainians, it sounds like they'll do this, or we will do this, and the Russians will do nothing. They'll absorb all the costs for a while, then Putin will throw his hands up and say, I surrender to Western demands. That's not what's going to happen. What he's going to do is counter-escalate. And if there are not many Russian troops in Ukraine now, you can rest assured that if we up the ante, there will be many more Russian troops in there, and you can rest assured that they will fight to the death. Because again, from Putin's point of view, this is a vital strategic interest, and he has no intention of losing. So we can inflict significant costs on him, but he will stay the course, because anybody who studies international relations history knows great powers are willing to absorb huge amounts of punishment when they think core vital interests are at stake, and that's what's going on here.
And as you point out in your New York Times article, John Mearsheimer, Don't Arm Ukraine, the U.S., of course, has a longstanding doctrine known as the Monroe Doctrine, and that we would not look kindly upon Canada or Mexico making military and security alliances with, say, China or Russia. It simply is a non-starter. So, but given that the eastward expansion of NATO has happened, and it's obviously been counterproductive, and it was certainly against the wishes of Gorbachev, and he believes that there was some kind of a deal or promise made that was broken. how do you undo this damage? Because I don't think, you know, it's not a mutually exclusive situation as far as I'm concerned, in the sense that NATO expansion eastward has obviously been a huge mistake. Also, I think Russia is in many ways a gangster state run by, a kleptocratic gangster state run by, a mafia boss. And he's tough and he will do whatever he has. As you say, he's not going to give in on Ukraine. But he's also, you know, he started in power, after all, by killing a bunch of his own citizens, by blowing up apartment buildings to go after the Chechens. So this is an incredibly ruthless man, and he's a problem in himself. We've never had this combination of organized crime and national security, nuclear weapons and the mafia.
But if that's true, Ian, why does anybody think that we can drive the costs up to the point where he's going to quit? It makes no sense.
Well, I agree with you entirely. They don't know who he is. They don't get him, you know. And Bush looked into his eyes and saw his soul. This is somebody that is not going to back down. But my question is...
Exactly. And by the way, if you do back him into a corner, let's just say we are able to raise the cost to an enormous level, and he is in a desperate situation... You want to remember, he has thousands of nuclear warheads that are aimed at us. And who knows what will happen when he's in a desperate situation. Because the one scenario where someone might use nuclear weapons is where they think their survival is threatened. So we don't want to be in the position of boxing him in, putting him in a corner. We do not want to be in the position of making him feel desperate. Because, again, he has thousands of nuclear weapons. And what's truly amazing about this is Ukraine is not a vital strategic interest for the United States. It is for Russia, but it's not for the United States. You'll notice that John McCain, who's never seen a war he didn't want to fight, finally found one in the case of Ukraine. For all his hawkishness, McCain and Lindsey Graham are not talking about fighting, American forces fighting in Ukraine. And that's because it's not a vital strategic interest. So why would you risk nuclear war? Or why would you risk exacerbating the situation in Ukraine and in Eastern Europe more generally for an area or a country that's not a vital strategic interest? This is crazy.
Well, you could take that further, though, John Mearsheimer. We have Article 5 arrangements with the Baltic states, who are now members of NATO. Would the American people go to nuclear war to defend Estonia, Latvia, or Lithuania?
I agree. And the fact is that we made a commitment, an Article 5 commitment, to defend the Baltic states when we extended NATO to include them in the year 2004. And we did it thinking we would never have to defend them. That, of course, is why we did it. But it was remarkably foolish. And what happens if the Russians, who are much better positioned to fight a war in the Baltic states than we are, actually used military force in Latvia or Estonia? What are we going to do then? We don't have the conventional forces available to fight there. And even if we did, do we really want to fight the Russians in the Baltic states? With regard to using nuclear weapons, I hardly think we're going to do that. But this is just more evidence of what a cockamamie foreign policy the United States has had for a long period of time. I mean, it's no accident that we have screwed up in Iraq, screwed up in Afghanistan, screwed up in Libya, now screwed up in Eastern Europe. The United States has the Midas touch in reverse. This is a country that's run by the gang that can't shoot straight.
And it does seem that it's the worst of all possible worlds, where you have an Article 5 agreement that, and as the Polish foreign minister recently said in a surreptitiously taped conversation, that membership in NATO is worthless. He described it in terms of the activities of Monica Lewinsky, that the Poles had to do that to the Americans. And the truth of the matter is that we have the worst of all possible worlds. Encroachment up to Russia's border without any real advantages, but the damage is already done. So, and obviously it would have been better to have some kind of neutral buffer zone there, but given that we are where we're at, how do we get out of this trap? That seems to be what Merkel is really concerned about. They think, and I suppose Hollande believes this too, that this situation is akin to the beginning of World War One, where you can get into a small conflagration can turn into a massive global conflagration, and in the age of nuclear weapons, this is simply unacceptable.
I don't think it's going to turn into a world war or a global conflagration. I do think there is a possibility of a major war in Eastern Europe that we could get dragged into. So I don't want to make light of it for one second. But you ask, you know, what is the solution? How do we get out of this? As I said when we started off the conversation, if you look at what Merkel and Obama and Merkel and Putin are talking about now, they're talking about coming up with a meaningful ceasefire. They're not talking about how to solve this problem. And the reason is that to solve this problem, we would have to take NATO expansion and EU expansion explicitly off the table. We would have to tell the Russians that we're not going to try to make Ukraine part of the West, and we are going to try and return it to its pre-2014 status as a neutral buffer state. That's what we'd have to do. We'd have to work with Putin, and we'd have to respect Putin's national interests. We're not going to do that. We're incapable of doing that. Obama, even if he understood that that is what needs to be done, could not do it because John McCain and Lindsey Graham and many people in the Democratic Party would pound him over the head. He has no maneuver room. It'd be much easier to convince the Europeans, especially the Germans. You want to remember that this whole problem really began back in April 2008 at the Bucharest Summit, the NATO Bucharest Summit in April 2008. And at the end of that summit, a communique was issued that said that Georgia and Ukraine would become part of NATO. That's when all the trouble began. And by the way, Ian, in August 2008, just a few months later, you had a war between Russia and Georgia. And that was precipitated by the April 2008 communique. And what's going on now with Ukraine is fallout from back then. What we have to do is we have to walk away from that pronouncement. We have to walk away from our effort to peel Ukraine out of Russia's orbit. And we're incapable of doing that.
Well, the miscalculation on the part of the mercurial Georgian leader that got sucker-punched by Putin, he was encouraged by Randy Scheuermann, who, guess what, was John McCain's national security advisor at that time, and McCain was running against Obama.
I'm hardly surprised. So, again, these people are incompetent.
Well, they're dangerous.
They're dangerous. That's exactly right. Again, look at what's happened in Libya. Look at what's happened in Iraq. Look at what's happened in Afghanistan. Look at what's happening in Ukraine.
Well, John Meerschaum, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was my pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with John Meerschaum, who is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science and the co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. His books include The Tragedy of Great Power Politics and the bestseller The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy. His latest book is Why Leaders Lie, The Truth About Lying in International Politics, and he has an article at the New York Times, Don't Arm Ukraine. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking with the veteran Pulitzer Prize-winning American photojournalist Lindsay Addario.
We don't wanna fight tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Lindsay Addario, an American photojournalist whose work appears regularly in the New York Times, National Geographic, and Time magazine. She has covered conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Darfur, and the Congo, and has received numerous awards, including the MacArthur Genius Grant and the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. Her latest book just out is It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lindsay Addario.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And your story, and particularly the photographs, are just extraordinary. And, of course, it comes at a time when journalism itself is somewhat on trial, with NBC news anchor Brian Williams being suspended for 6 months for exaggerating about his Iraq war experiences. And your experiences are incredibly real and vividly portrayed and recounted in your book. What's your understanding about that disconnect? I mean, there you know, is a line between fabrication and embellishment. We all embellish our resumes, right?
Sure.
So how do you see that line?
It's difficult to talk about because I don't know exactly what happened. I can say that when I'm covering a war, things are incredibly intense and a lot is happening at once. And obviously, all of my senses are peaked at the same time. So it's important to get things straight, especially if your job is a journalist, and to make sure that you're recounting the facts. But for me as a photographer, obviously, those issues are not as difficult because I'm photographing what I'm seeing and I have proof. I do go back and check captions. I think for any journalist, it's important to check with your colleagues, with the people you're covering, and make sure you have things straight, because it is... It does happen that you remember things differently, and then you begin to believe that memory. And I think that it's important to continuously check with your colleagues and people on the ground.
But is it a male thing to want to sort of exaggerate heroics? In many ways, it seems to me that a lot of the popularity of this new Clint Eastwood film, American Sniper, has to do with, as you know, you recall, after the Vietnam War, the Rambo movies tried to rewrite history, and I'm wondering if there's one of the things that's in the sort of American zeitgeist is the fact that we can't deal with the fact that we've lost every war since World War II, so we have a kind of compulsion to rewrite history and to romanticize it.
Sure. I don't think it's a male thing. I think men and women, I think anyone in war would like to remember things perhaps differently than they happened, especially when we're talking about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which have clearly not been very successful. So what was interesting about American Sniper is that the quiet moments of that movie and the moments when you show a veteran going home and dealing with his family life and dealing with PTSD, those are issues that we don't see enough right now. Those are issues that our society is not talking about enough right now. And to me, the veteran suicides, the difficulties veterans have and in inserting themselves back into society, those are the issues we need to be talking about, because we can't rewrite what happened in the war.
And how did you deal with the traumas that you witnessed? Did you ever have anything resembling PTSD?
Yeah, I did. I think after I did a 2-month embed in the Korngal Valley, I was there on and off for 2 months and was literally...
That's in Afghanistan, right on the border with Pakistan. And
exactly.
Sebastian made a film about it, right?
Exactly. The same place.
Yeah.
And we were at the Korngal Outpost, which was the main base of that, of the Korngal Valley for the 173rd Airborne. And we were living on the side of a mountain for 2 months, basically, and going on patrols every day, getting shot at, mortared. And at the end of that embed, we went on a week-long operation called Operation Rock Avalanche, where we jumped out of Black Hawk helicopters and literally walked through the mountains with everything on our backs for 6 days. And on the sixth day, we were ambushed by the Taliban, and three soldiers were shot and one was killed, Sergeant Rugel. And after, I remember right after that happened, I wanted to get on the first helicopter out. And I kept saying to Captain Kearney, who's now Major Kearney, I kept saying, Kearney, please, can I get on whatever helicopter? And I was so ashamed of my fear. I was so ashamed to be this woman sort of on the side of the mountain with all men except for my female colleague, Elizabeth Rubin, begging to leave, because it's the last thing you want to be doing as a journalist. But I just knew that I couldn't take it anymore. I was not... I just was paralyzed by my fear and the fact that we would have to walk for another 24 or 48 hours. I just couldn't handle it. And luckily, I was able to fly out with Rugel's belongings, and that's how I got out of the corn gall. But I think after that embed, I really struggled. I mean, I kept breaking down and crying, and I would be in the middle of a dinner with friends, and I had to excuse myself and go to the bathroom and lock myself in the bathroom and cry, and certain noises would set me off. And that was a scene actually in American Sniper when there was a drill going off or something. And I remember that so distinctly. For years, anything would sort of put me on edge. And also, I would be driving down the street in a place like Westport, Connecticut, where I'm from. And if I saw a plastic bag on the side of the road, I thought it was an IED. And obviously, that doesn't make any sense. But when you spend years in war zones, that's what happens.
Well, in the movie that Sebastian Younger and Tim Hetherington made, the soldiers in that movie keep talking about Rock Avalanche. It traumatized them. So,
yeah, I mean, it was incredibly intense. I mean, yeah. I think everyone was traumatized because right. It was, and it was also the soldiers had really suffered a lot being at this very remote outpost across the Corn Gall Valley for months. And so it was a lot to handle at the end of a long, long stint in Afghanistan.
And again, I'm speaking with Lindsay Addario, who's an American photographer, photojournalist whose work appears regularly in the New York Times, National Geographic, and Time magazine. She has covered conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Darfur, and the Congo, and has received numerous awards, including the MacArthur Genius Grant and the Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. Her latest book just out is It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. So let's start with the book, and because it's a wonderful and extraordinary, it's a beautifully written book, but it's about your family, which is fascinating, the story of your parents and your mother bringing home the friend who ends up becoming a part of a kind of triangle, which is, you know, sort of perfectly and seamlessly woven into your life. And then, of course, your first photographic experiences, you know, professionally are the photographs of transgender prostitutes in the Meatpacking District of New York. So how did you make that journey? I mean, I guess your father gave you a camera, right? Is that the inciting incident, as they say here in Hollywood?
I think it was the combination of many things. First of all, I grew up in Connecticut with three older sisters, my mother, my father, and a very incredibly loving open household where my parents, from the time we were very young, welcomed everyone into our household. And it didn't matter if you were gay, straight, transgender. It didn't matter. No one asked any questions. It was whether you were a good person, a fun person, someone who could come and hang out and have a good time. And that's sort of how we were raised. And I think being raised in that household really contributed to my ability to be a journalist and a non-judgmental person and someone who can walk into basically anyone's life and not feel uncomfortable or put off and feel like, oh, this person's different, because it never mattered to me. And my parents never made that an issue. They never pointed out things like that in other people. And so when my dad left and left with Bruce, and he's still with Bruce, they've been together over 30 years, I was very young. So it was something that I didn't really understand at that time. And I came to understand as I became a woman. And Bruce is very much a part of our family. He's another parent to us. And I think it's very important. None of us as sisters, we all accept everything. I mean, that we are an incredibly loving family and we all spend a lot of time together still.
So do you think that has served you well in these war fronts where you're dealing with different cultures? And, you know, we do have the image of the ugly American. And in that kind of world, if you're the ugly American, you're likely to get shot.
Sure. I think that it has served me well. I think that I try and be very respectful of other cultures. I try and do my homework. I try and learn about where I'm going before I go. I try not to stick out. I try really hard to be able to blend in and to be able to observe before I get to work.
And you went to Afghanistan. I mean, 9/11 obviously set you on this path as a photographer or war photographer. But you had been in Afghanistan and then you went back. for the U.S. invasion after 9/11. So tell me about the earlier experiences and how that served you well in the deployment with the U.S.
Sure. So in 2000, I moved to India. I wanted to start working overseas, and I wanted to be a foreign correspondent, a photographer. And while I was living there, I was renting a room from the Dow Jones bureau chief, and I was incredibly poor. I could not get an assignment to save my life. I would get one assignment a month, if that. And I was renting a room from the Dow Jones bureau chief, and he came home from a trip to Afghanistan. And many correspondents based in India at the time were covering Afghanistan under the Taliban. And he came back and he said, hey, you know, you're a woman. You should go to Afghanistan and cover women living under the Taliban and what their lives are like, because there are not many women working there, and it's a really important story to cover. And so I didn't even think twice. I was 26 years old, and I thought, sure, that's a great idea. And he gave me a list of email contacts at the UN and small NGOs, and I sent out a bunch of emails, and people responded, which was actually shocking to me, because I thought, I'm no one. Why are they even taking the time to answer? But I guess there was so little media coverage at the time that any coverage would have been helpful. And so I went, and that really was, it sort of opened Pandora's box, because I've been going to Afghanistan for every year for the past 15 years, and I've watched things improve, and I've watched things get worse, and I've seen, I've been able to follow the story with a sense of history, with a sense of personal investment as well.
Do you think it'll get worse after the withdrawal?
I do. I think in many parts of the country, the Taliban is already very active. And so I don't think things will change that much there. I think in the cities, that's really where we have to watch and see what happens. I mean, there are, you know, it's been 15 years of people going to school and being educated and women starting to work. And so I'm not sure they're going to give that up that easily. Mm. But it will be interesting to see what happens in Kabul, for example.
But do you share, I mean, I wouldn't say share the sense of futility. It's got to be difficult for soldiers who've seen their friends die, and perhaps some of them have lost limbs, and parents who've lost sons and daughters, to wonder whether it was futile. Do you have a sense of what did I risk my life for over those years?
I don't have that sense as a journalist. What did I risk my life for? Because I know what I risked my life for. I risked my life to be there and to document these wars so that our policymakers and citizens in the U.S. and overseas can see what happens on the front line. Of course, I had a sense of futility. Of course, when I'm watching a 21-year-old bleed out at some field hospital in the middle of southern Afghanistan, I ask myself, what are we doing here? Why are we here? And when I'm watching the scout team carry Sergeant Rugel's body through this desolate landscape where there are no Afghans, I mean, there are no villagers even living. And I think to myself, why are we here? What are we doing? Why are we fighting this war in a place where people don't even want us here? And so, but those are things that I keep to myself, of course, because I'm a journalist and my job is not to sit there and talk about what I think. My job is to document the reality and to document what's happening and to send those pictures home and to write an accurate caption and to report with integrity.
So how did Turkey become your base? It seems that it did.
It became my base because I was living in Mexico City and I had a boyfriend who was cheating on me and I wanted to move overseas. And I called the New York Times and said, where do you need a photographer? And they said, Istanbul. Dexter Filkins is moving there. And I said, great, I'll go. And I was on the next plane. That's how I ended up there.
Right. And of course, you know, that is where you met your husband.
It is where I met my husband. I lived there for 7 years.
Right. And you were actually on your way for an assignation in Tehran, right? When you had dinner with him, right?
Correct. I was introduced to him through another journalist and a friend. And she said, so Paul is moving to Istanbul and you have so many friends in Istanbul. Will you introduce him to your crowd? And I said, of course. And I was on my way into Tehran the next morning. And so I introduced him to everyone and left contact details. And by the time I came back, he was part of our crowd.
So in terms of our crowd, it's a boys' club. And so how did you crash the boys' club?
So in Istanbul, it was not a boys' club. Right. In Istanbul,
it
was
journalists. But in the war zones, it tends to be, yeah.
Well, I think that it takes I think it takes years of just being there and proving yourself and just going back. I think increasingly, I would like to say I see more and more women, but actually on the front line, I don't see very many women. I don't think there are many female war photographers. There are many female war correspondents, but not photographers necessarily. And I would absolutely love to see the day where there are more women out there, because there, when I'm covering the front line and I'm surrounded by men, it's a great pleasure to run into another woman, because it's just nice to have another woman around.
And you and most of your colleagues, at least in terms of photojournalists, you basically depend upon the pictures being taken, right? I mean, you take the pictures, but then you're freelancers. You live off. In your early days, you were just begging to sell it to anybody, right? And then once you develop contacts, clearly, you have a little more of a revenue stream. But describe that kind of precarious economic existence.
So I think there's a bit of a misconception. So, for example, the way it works now is that the New York Times will call me and say, we want you to go into Libya to cover the war. And so I will be on assignment for them every day for as long as I'm in Libya. So it doesn't matter how many pictures are published or if I sell anything, because I'm on assignment for the New York Times. And they have first rights to those photos, and they can do whatever they'd like with them. And then once they've published what they want, I send those photos to Getty Images, and they syndicate those photos for resales. The other option for a freelancer is to just save your money and send yourself, much like I used to do when I was first starting out, and try and sell those pictures from the field. Now, I'm 41 years old, and I'm not willing to just save my money and send myself to a war zone anymore, because I've been kidnapped, I've been in a car accident, I've lost drivers. I'm not willing to take that risk right now at this age. So I think it just depends where you're at in your career and what you're willing to do.
Well, let's talk about what happened to you in Libya. I mean, that was an incredibly chaotic war, even though I guess we didn't really call it a war.
And
it was sort of drive-by liberation.
I've never heard that term before. It was an uprising. So it was a popular uprising. So basically, as we saw in the Arab Spring across the Middle East, people rose up and tried to depose their leaders. And so that was happening with Gaddafi in Libya in early 2011.
And what happened to you in terms of being...
So I was, like many journalists, snuck into Libya through Egypt in late February of 2011. And Gaddafi did not want journalists covering the uprising. So it was always a risk that if we got caught by any government soldiers, that we would be not only kidnapped but killed, because Gaddafi was very clear that he made public statements saying all foreign journalists are spies, and if you catch them, kill them. So that was a risk that we were taking. And so very early on, I started covering the front line. So I spent about 2 weeks moving around with the rebels as the front line shifted from east to west. And Gaddafi's troops were always several kilometers ahead and moving, trying to push their way east. And so it was incredibly violent, because the guys we were with weren't trained soldiers. They didn't really know what they were doing. They were engineers, doctors, teachers who had risen up, and they were literally learning how to use arms on the front line. And Gaddafi at that time had he was using airstrikes as well. So not only did he have a trained military, but he was using airstrikes. So helicopter gunships would come in, aircraft would come and drop bombs right next to us, and there was no telling where they would land. So it was very stressful and very difficult. And one day we were in Ajdabia, a town on the front line, and we had a sense that the town was going to fall to Gaddafi's troops, because civilians started fleeing, and there are signs when a town is about to fall. And I was with three colleagues for the New York Times, Anthony Shadid, Steve Farrell, and Tyler Hicks, and we were trying to negotiate how long we should stay. And basically, we stayed too long. We made a decision to stay longer than we should have, because we wanted to get the best reporting, and we wanted to get the freshest reporting. And war in war, things change very quickly. And so I think it's pretty natural that people want more material. And so by the time we decided to pull east, Gaddafi's troops came not from behind us, but they went all the way around and flanked the desert and set up a checkpoint on the road in front of us. And we saw the checkpoint as we were fleeing. And I said, those are Gaddafi's troops. And everyone in the car laughed at me and said, absolutely not. Are you crazy? They're behind us. And I said, no one else in Libya has those uniforms. And sure enough, Tyler said, go, 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 drive, don't stop. And our driver panicked. And our driver stopped the car at the checkpoint. And in that moment, everyone was ripped out of the car. I had locked my door and put my head in my lap. And I was sitting directly behind the driver. And in that moment, the rebels that we had been with started opening fire on Gaddafi's troops and on the checkpoint we were at. And so literally there were bullets everywhere and we were caught in the crossfire. So everyone is being sort of held by one of Gaddafi's guys and each one of us is trying to make a run for it. And there was a small sort of one floor cement building off to the right. And we tried to run for cover. And we eventually made it behind that building. And a handful of Gaddafi's troops said, lie down, face down on the ground. And we knew they were going to execute us. I mean, they each had a gun to our heads and they said, lie down on your stomachs. And that means execution. It's very clear. And we each started begging for our lives. I mean, it was a very sort of solitary, desperate moment where each one of us was looking down a gun barrel, just begging for our lives. And I remember my mouth was so dry, I could barely get the words out. And someone, the commander came over in that moment, and we were not aware of this, but Anthony explained after, because Anthony had spoken Arabic, that the commander came over and said, you can't shoot them, they're American. And there was sort of a fight over whether or not to execute us, and they decided not to. And instead, they pulled my shoes off my feet and pulled the laces out of my sneakers and tied me up and carried each one of us to the front line and placed us in vehicles tied up and sitting on the front line while artillery and bullets and everything landed all around us and we couldn't do anything. They were just watching us terrified. And they kept us there for hours. And eventually they decided to move us and they brought us to another position. And repeatedly we were threatened with execution and punched in the face. And the men were really beaten on the back of the heads with gun butts. And for me, I was groped repeatedly. And that went on for the first 3-4 days were very violent. And the last 2 days we were under house arrest in this sort of VIP prison. And eventually we were released.
Well, we're very grateful for your book and for your time here with us today.
Thank you. Lindsay. Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Lindsay Addario, who is an American photojournalist whose work appears regularly in the New York Times, National Geographic, and Time magazine. She has covered conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, Darfur, and the Congo, and has received numerous awards, including the MacArthur Genius Grant and the Pulitzer Prize in International Reporting. Her latest book, just out is It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was